morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass.
Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn. Who says school is just for children? This hour we inaugurate our Back to School Book Club. This year we're going to be revisiting some of the books that you may or may not have read in school, but always wish that you had. And if you are in school, you can consider this extra credit, and I hope you ask your teacher for extra credit for participating in our book club. We have a lot to talk about with our first selection, and a very, very important writer who was so crucial to the really formation of the United States of America. Common Sense is our first selection by Thomas Paine. He had no formal training as a writer, not much schooling, but we remember so many slogans from him. These are the times that try men's souls. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. We'll be talking about Common Sense, and you were invited to join us. I know many of you have read the selection, and we're anxious to hear what you think about it. 1-800-486-8655. Email us at talk@WPR.org, or post on our Facebook page, please, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or send a tweet to @KDunnShow. Joining us for this and future book club discussions, and we're so happy that he is Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Russ, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. Thank you.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with a little bit of background about Thomas Paine. No formal training as a writer, not much schooling, but an hugely influential figure in American history.
Yes, and Paine's contribution comes from his ability to popularize a revolutionary message. He wasn't so much a theorist of the revolution as the person who was able to communicate it in an everyday, compelling parlance that really galvanized white Americans in the continent.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about his meeting Ben Franklin and how important that may have been. We all need a mentor. It sounds like Ben Franklin may have been his.
Right. So he's in London, and I think he meets Ben Franklin in September 1774, and then he emigrates to America. And I think it's on Franklin's encouragement that America is a place to begin anew, to begin again, because Paine had a series of setbacks, financial, marital, religious, in England. And Franklin encourages him to come to America and try his hand there. And what he does is he comes to the United States, lands in Philadelphia, and begins a magazine, the Pennsylvania Magazine, and immediately starts publishing a wide range of pieces, from everything on the abolition of slavery to British atrocities in East India. And this type of activity, this type of publishing and editing activity, leads up to the publication of Common Sense.
Mm-hmm. You, I know, have some interesting things to say about his father being a corset maker, which you say you always thought was ironic.
You're right. I think that you have these whalebone corsets meant to constrict the rib cages of women, imprison women's bodies literally in this certs and these according to these gender prescriptions. That this man who comes from this father becomes, one, the foremost liberationist in the New World. Mm. I always thought that was just a clever irony of history.
Mm-hmm. I imagine him sitting at these tables, perhaps having a pint or two, talking about big ideas of the day with big thinkers of the day. Was that indeed the way some of the ideas were formulated?
Yes, this is very much the case that Paine's coming out of a whole sort of coffee house in tavern culture, in which men and women in some cases are debating, disputing, and going over the preeminent political ideas of the day. In fact, it was Benjamin Rush, another of the founding fathers, who tells Paine, I believe in some stories, that he should call his book Common Sense. Paine originally had proposed Plain Truth. Mm. But Common Sense is the title that came to Paine based on the suggestion of one of his colleagues in this sort of revolutionary ferment of the time. And what would happen would be that there would be these coffee houses filled with tobacco, coffee, and other drinks, as you've alluded to, like rum, in which people were actively engaging and reading and replaying the major debates of the day. And that's what Paine's contribution, we need to see it as entering that sort of coffee house culture. So it's not that just people were taking Paine and, you know, downloading it on their Kindles and reading it privately, but Paine's text is a public text. And that's one of the things that we need, that helps us understand how it really spread like wildfire across the colonial landscape.
And tell me, Russ, about the other founding fathers. Did they admire Paine, or was he considered too radical in his time?
Well, it's yes and no. So before, and this is one of the first stories, is that before George Washington crosses the Delaware, right? It's a cold night. He instructs the officers in his army to read the first number of The American Crisis, authored by Thomas Paine, to the troops to rally them, to fire them, to stoke their zeal for the mission they're about to undertake. And as you already alluded to in the introduction to the show, those words are, "These are the times that try men's souls." So Washington and other founding fathers, you know, recognize that Paine was indispensable to the cause of American liberty. In fact, Congress will vote him a farm in New Rochelle, New York, that's confiscated from a loyalist estate later in the Revolution. So on the one hand, Congress and other important figures in the story of American independence are right on Paine's side. But at the same time, Paine becomes a little too radical for the founding fathers. And by the end of his life, there's a complete disavowal of what Paine stood for by some of the founding fathers, principally John Adams, who in many cases seemed to be jealous of Paine, because he will say that, you know, actually, I thought of all the ideas that Paine had came up with. He just put them in a more popular form. And in his diary, Adams confesses that, or says, "I generated all these ideas a year before Common Sense. So if you really want to start dating when the revolution happened, it begins not with Common Sense, but with this little tract that I wrote earlier." So there's a bit of competition there, but it's also the fact that Paine, besides the idea of personal enmity that he created with some of the more genteel founding fathers, it's also the fact that Paine had very radical ideas about the irrelevance of religion, about the limitations of nationalism, about the abolition of slavery, that made him a poor fit for the pantheon of the founding fathers.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them whenever you'd like to call in. I know that many of you did follow your assignment and read Common Sense and read about the life of Thomas Paine, and we sure would like to have you be a part of our vocal part of our first book club of the year. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We welcome your phone calls and your participation in our book club. Our teacher is Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is currently teaching, actually, Common Sense to his class. So we're delighted to have a chance to talk about this incredibly important document in American history, and this very important man in American history. He really makes the case, and he outlines it so specifically for independence, that this is the time for independence. The circumstances are ripe, and if we wait any period of time, it will be more difficult for us to become independent. He very carefully lays that out, doesn't he, Russ?
Yes, and before I address that, I was I was just thinking about how you were inviting people to call in. You know, I certainly want to hear from your listeners. And I think it's important that we think of ourselves as a type of virtual coffee house, if you will. You know, I was talking
yes,
about
I like that.
That. That tavern culture. So we either all have our tea or something stronger by us as we start to talk about this. But to go to your point, the thing about pain that I think makes him such an interesting case is precisely his ability to use words that would translate into action. So Paine didn't just want to make a case for independence. He wanted to make the case for independence now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what interests so many academics, but also politicians, historians, this ability to translate word into action. And that's what common sense was able to do. There had been, you know, certain types of, you know, Bunker Hill had occurred. There had been minor skirmishes. But Paine is the one who, for our purposes today, seems to come up with the phrasing, the words, the rallying cries, the sound bites of a revolution.
Hmm.
And, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to go to a phone call.
Oh, great.
Okay. All right. Mm. Bill in Reedsburg is our first caller for our book club. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just was mentioning to your screener that I'm finishing up reading a book called 1491, and it's the story of the Americas before Columbus. And the author is, he comes right out and says that he's a journalist, he's not a historian, he's not a biographer or anything like that. But he mentions in there how various different leaders of the revolution were greatly influenced by the society and the beliefs of the Indians in the Americas at the time of the revolution and before the revolution.
Russ.
There is, that is true in the sense that the Iroquois Confederacy is influential upon Ben Franklin and other leaders in the idea of thinking about a union of several parts. More generally, though, it's a story not of happy migration of Native American ideas to revolutionary or American thought. More generally, what we have is a story of the expropriation of land, forced migration, and genocide. So it's hard. It's I think nice for us today to say that there are sort of American Indian traces in how we understand the United States to act. But we also have to remember that so many of those traces lie subverted in a history of violence.
Thanks very much for the call, Bill. Let's go next to Bruce in Toma. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. I was wondering what influence John Locke had or didn't have on Thomas Paine?
Yeah, Locke, I think, is a fundamental figure in terms of the American Revolution. I think his influence is not as deep on Paine as it is upon other, the influence of other philosophers, part of the Scottish Enlightenment, who were called who championed common sense thinking. Locke is more important, I think, in how he shows up in terms of the Declaration of Independence, right? Because Locke's famous phrase is that people have the pursuit of life, liberty, and property. And, of course, Jefferson will change that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Locke is more responsible for the tradition of liberalism as it makes its way to the United States. And there's a different tradition coming from Montesquieu and others that as a tradition of civic republicanism that Paine is part of, which is that you would have virtue participating in a polis, in a community by sort of disinvesting yourself from the any particular interest that you may have. Now, all this is very academic and not very interesting, but and this is actually what Paine realized. Paine realized that he didn't have to mention Locke. He didn't have to mention Montesquieu. He didn't have to mention Shaftesbury. What he had to do was popularize these ideas. So if you look back through Paine's pamphlet, I think he only refers to one authority by name, and that's John Milton. And then there's a lot on the Bible. So Paine wasn't trying to give an academic paper with footnotes. What he wanted to do was to communicate a message in vernacular terms that everyone could understand. So Paine, in many cases, is uninterested himself in those philosophical antecedents of American liberty.
Let's talk about the monarchy for a moment, because he certainly addresses this pretty thoroughly in Common Sense. Of more worth is one honest man to society and in the sight of God than all the crowned ruffians that ever lived. He was really sickened by hereditary rank and privilege, and he writes about it quite extensively. I want to zero in on one area because, as you know, we're talking on Yom Kippur, and I wondered if there was some anti-Semitism in what he had to say about the Jewish religion creating the concept of kings. I read that passage and I thought, what's he getting at here? Is there historical accuracy here, or is there some anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I think there is some anti-Semitism there, but at the same time, you know, he also writes in the pamphlet quite approvingly of the Jewish diaspora, and he writes, some versions of the pamphlet have this other letter and an appendix that he wrote to the Quakers. And the Quakers are, of course, a nonviolent sect. And Paine writes this, and you can see the anti-Semitism here in what I'm going to read, but what you will also see is a sort of admiration. So Paine writes this, "Even the dispersing of the Jews, though foretold by our Savior, was affected by arms." And that's important because what Paine is looking at in terms of the history of the Jewish diaspora, say, there is a necessity for violence. There's a necessity for armed rebellion. Mm. And he takes that, you know, the ancient Jewish example as instructive for the cause of America. So you can certainly find in Common Sense the prevailing religious prejudices of the day, including for Muslims. So Paine here, however, also looks to the Bible, also looks to religious precedent for authority for, you know, fomenting large-scale rebellion. And to that, when he's instructing the Quakers, he says, "You Quakers need to look to the example of the Jews to understand why one wants to rebel against a monarch."
Mm, interesting. Jack in Green Bay, hi.
Yes, good morning. As somebody who studied and taught history and government, it always amazes me, especially, not to sound partisan, especially those who call themselves Republicans, that they ignore Paine's central role in energizing the revolution vis-a-vis for freedom, for security, and the, if I can use the word again, the irrelevance of religion in government as compared to ethics, community, and the common good. And they completely seem to pretend that Paine and all the founders, everything was, we're a nation under God, we must follow the Bible, etc. Could you comment about how this whole segment in our society, especially when elections are around the corner, you know, they wave the Bible in one hand and that's the mantra. Any comments about that?
I think that the word republicanism, as it was used in the 18th century, has gone a complete reversal in how we understand it today with the Republican Party, which is not to make an anti-Republican Party statement. So when I'm talking about this with my class, I always make the distinction between big R Republican, Republicanism, or Republican, big R Republican, of the contemporary Republican Party. Then there's the little r Republicanism of the 18th century. And to understand what that meant, we have to go back to the Latin root of the word itself. And again, I don't want to get too arcane here, but it comes from a phrase, the res publica, which is meant the public thing. And what republicanism meant, that there would be this common goal, this common shared principle of the public, of the polis, of the political community that everyone would participate in. And to do so, you needed to have a vibrant public sphere. You needed to have vibrant public institutions. You needed to have leaders who are committed to public values, not private values, not to personal advancement, not to individual glory, but to what was called the common weal or the common good. That's what republicanism meant in the 18th century. And, you know, I think we can today very handily debate, you know, what has happened to that 18th century sensibility. I mean, I know, Kathleen, that, you know, this is part of, you know, this is a question that you should take a whack at, because so much of your show is often about contemporary politics, and you've read Payne here, and what has happened, or where do we see the continuance of those 18th century ideals in, you know, our contemporary discourse today?
I think we see many of them. When you go to the last line of the book, let the names of Whig and Tory be extinct, and let none other be heard among us than those of a good citizen, an open and resolute friend, and a virtuous supporter of the rights of mankind and of the free and independent states of America. We're so far from that. We're so entrenched in what our political beliefs are. We don't think of ourselves as one, really.
Right. And, you know, there's a really cunning thing that's happening in what you just read that I think it's important to remark upon. You know, Payne writes, let the names of Whig and Tory be extinct, and let none other be heard among us, as you read. But what Payne is actually doing here is, and when I teach this, I ask my class about this. And what we often come to the determination is that Payne can only say that the political parties of Whig and Tory, Democrat and Republican, should be extinct because he feels he has already won the battle and that there are only Whigs now. Mm-hmm. So it's fine for there only to be no more Whigs and Tories, because in Payne's mind, everybody should be a Whig.
We need to pause for a moment and we'll return and start taking phone calls. We're having our book club and we're sitting around. I wish we could all see each other. That would be fun, wouldn't it? I guess we can in our mind's eyes. But we're sitting around drinking cup of coffee, got a cup of coffee, kind of cold here now, but as Thomas Paine did with Benjamin Franklin and other great minds, talking about very large issues that have influenced our lives and the start of our government and a revolution, big stuff. And our first book club selection, because it is big stuff, is Common Sense by Thomas Paine. And our guest is Russ Castronovo. He's the leader of our conversation, professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. For those of you who have read the book, or, you know, we don't expect everybody. Sometimes people come to class and they haven't read the book. It's better if you have, and we'd love to hear from you. But if you have comments about Thomas Paine, or if you've been studying as we have his words, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Lines are open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for our book club, Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. I wanted to make 3 points. Two of them are questions. One is that Tom Paine was very much esteemed and influential in the early European settlers into Wisconsin. I just did a Google to find Painesville, which was a settlement, a congregation, free-thinking congregation. I guess the chapel still exists around Franklin, Wisconsin. These were a lot of German immigrants, 1848ers, et cetera, who really were inspired by him. At Turner Hall, we still have a collection in old German script. A multi-volume thing is about 3 volumes of Tom Paine's political works. And another three volumes or so of his theological works, which surprised me because I didn't think of him as a theologian, but he's got three volumes worth of things there that were given to us, I think, by another Turner Society in Wisconsin. And he was pretty much kind of the most esteemed figure of the Turner movement originally in the mid-1800s. So that's one observation, but I am... so I'm kind of wondering what he would have written that would have filled up three volumes of theological works. But also, to some degree, the Tea Party movement contemporaneously has been influenced or cited Tom Paine as an inspiring figure, which some of us have thought is somewhat ironic, but perhaps we're wrong. So I'd like your guest to comment if he has any thoughts on that.
I'm sure he does. Thanks, Art.
Yeah, Art, those are great observations, and I'm really... pleased to hear that there's a Painesville, Wisconsin, and I'll have to visit. you are exactly right about Paine's influence across Europe. And Paine, I want to point out and really underscore this point, saw himself as an American, but also saw himself, and his phrase was, a citizen of the world. And Paine never, to say that Paine wanted independence in America is to sell him short. Because what Paine really was looking for was worldwide emancipation. And we can see this in his biography. After the American Revolution is successful, he travels to France and participates in the French Revolution. And his ideas continue to disseminate. And you're quite right, Art, to say that in 1848, that revolutionary energy that sweeps across Europe, it would be not a surprise at all to see that Paine's legacy has a hand in that type of movement. Insofar as Paine is being cited by the Tea Party, this is one of the delightful or maddening aspects of Paine, depending on your perspective. And Paine is cited again and again by people of all sorts of political persuasion. He's cited by libertarians. He's cited by Democrats. He's cited by socialists. He's cited by conservatives. And I think the line, actually, I have it here, that the Tea Party would like about Paine is when he writes of government. He says, society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness. Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. And I think the distinction that we have to make here is that when Paine is writing this, he's writing about monarchical government. Mm-hmm. He's writing about a government with a king. Tea Party members, however, are writing about the welfare state. And these are two very different entities. And it's, you know, to use Paine in this way is to take things out of context. But I should also readily acknowledge that that's where politics, how politics are often conducted, by taking things out of context. So in many ways, we could think about Paine's use of the Bible being analogous to the Tea Partier's use of Paine.
Mm-hmm. He also had, and I'm wondering how this aligns with politicians or political parties now or throughout the years since he died, this belief, which is an interesting thing, that every person has this divine spark that impels that person to do good for all people. This incredibly optimistic view mm-hmm. about who we are as human beings and we can do the right thing.
Right. And that is this Enlightenment belief that is fundamental to what Paine believes. And the interesting thing about this is that one could say that our distortion about this today is that we believe that every person has this individual divine spark to do good for himself. And that's very different from doing good to others.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that's actually where we were talking earlier about those ideas of liberalism and individualism. I think that one of the things that we've lost in the Paineite tradition is that we've overemphasized the individual nature of his doctrine. And what we've forgotten is the notion of the public. What we've forgotten is the notion of doing good to others, because insofar as you are able to create a common wealth, right, not individual wealth, but common wealth, mm-hmm. that is how people will live the most fulfilling lives.
Mm. Gigi in Viroqua, hi.
Hi. One sentence at, in chapter four.
Oh, you're a really good student,
good, Gigi.
Gigi. I read the book.
Thank you.
And I tell all my students, if they're going to participate, you've got to have a passage in mind. So
okay.
This is great.
Okay. Well, since we always talk about the national debt, he wrote, mm-hmm. A national debt is a national bond, and when it bears no interest, it's in no case a grievance. And I right. wonder how that applies. Does it still apply? And, help. I don't understand that.
Gigi, you are, this is, I was hoping this would come up, and this is, you know, what I tell all my students, this is how we close read a text. We look at the passages or the sentences or the phrases that don't compute for us, that don't calculate, and that's where we find meaning. So this is wonderful. This is, you get an A for today, Gigi. this is a very different notion about debt. And what the founding fathers, Paine included, saw was that it was necessary to create debt, to have that common bond of a collective, but not only amongst Americans, because if they could be indebted to Spain, if they could be indebted to France, then France and Spain and other European powers would have an interest in seeing the young, struggling infant nation survive. Because if the United States goes under, then what happens to the debt? It doesn't get paid back. So what the American founding fathers and wanted to do specifically was to create indebtedness to European powers who would then sustain their cause. And there is a parallel today, right? So the United States or China owes a lot of the U.S. debt. Well, China has an interest in the stability of the United States. Because if the United States economy begins to become more rocky than it is, then it's going to reverberate to the across and imperil the Chinese economy. So we have to understand that there's this world connectedness in economics that Paine sees as the foundation for the sovereignty of America.
And as long as we're talking about passages, I'll bring one up that I found moving as well. Because if you remember the time, there still was a reluctance, of course there would be, to have a revolution, for heaven's sake. That some people were looking at England and saying that they had been benevolent. And he says, and I can't remember where it was, I have heard it asserted by some that as America hath flourished under her former connection with Great Britain, that the same connection is necessary toward her future happiness and will always have the same effect. Nothing can be more fallacious than this kind of argument. We may as well assert that because a child has thrived upon milk, that it is never to have meat, or that the first 20 years of our lives is to become a precedent for the next 20. Protected us, her motive was interest, not attachment. Did not protect us from our enemies on our account, but from her enemies on her account, from those who had no quarrel with us on any account and who will always be our enemies on the same account. Isn't that brilliant?
Oh, definitely. It's hitting so many different emotional chords,
right.
of parenting, which actually is part of the Lockean tradition that your earlier caller talked about, but also political, also economic. And he's here more specifically referring to the history of the Seven Years' War, which we also call the French and Indian War. And what Paine is seeing is that Americans are having to pay this immense burden of taxation to pay for this war against France. And Paine is saying, hey, we just want to trade with the world. We want to be good businessmen. We want to sell our commerce in Europe. We don't want to have wars. We just want prosperity. And it's England, militaristic England, that is really the problem here. And we need to ditch her because she's no longer a suitable parent. And what he's really arguing here for is the maturity of these young colonies to become an independent nation on their own. It's a wonderful passage.
Jean in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks, Kathleen. Great idea. The passage that strikes me as relevant today is in the paragraph that starts, but it is not so much the absurdity as the evil of hereditary succession, which concerns mankind. And in that paragraph, it's men who look upon themselves born to reign and others to obey soon grow insolent, selected from the rest of mankind, blah, blah. The world they act in differs so material materially from the world at large, that they have but little opportunity of knowing its true interests. And that just reminded me of our Republican presidential nominee.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way to think about this in terms of pain is, I think there is a way that, you know, people have said that Romney is disconnected, and we have the 47% video, which has really, you know, sent a torpedo to his campaign for many voters. Pain, however, was not out of touch, right? And this is what makes him such a genius. Pain's writing for artisans. He's writing for mechanics. He's writing for craftsmen, and in many cases, craftswomen, right? He's writing for laborers. He's writing both for the... He's not giving us a track that's built on erudition, right? You don't need special knowledge to parse his ideas. This is something that everyone gets. And the problem that Romney seems to be encountering is that he cannot convincingly come off as a man of the people, right? He can't rub elbows with NASCAR folks. He can't relate to people who don't own two Cadillacs. Payne, however, could, because, you know, he had experienced poverty. He had experienced the need to relocate because of a dead-end job that he had in Britain. Payne is someone who is in touch with a large swath of the white working class and laboring population. And when we say, you know, working class population in the colonies, to understand the respect, the position in life that craftsmen had in politics, in civil discourse of the time, right? If you were a printer whose arms were grimed with print at the end of the end of the day, you could also be Ben Franklin, and that's what Ben Franklin was, a printer. So to understand that to labor at a skilled profession in the United, in early America, was in many cases not a badge of shame, but about virtue, about civic virtue. So when Payne is talking about interest in that paragraph that you read, indeed, interest is this thing that we share together as a type of sensibility, if you will, a type of sensibility that we are all in this economy, we are all in this state, we are all in this cause together. And that's what he was able to tap into, rather than trying to set himself above and as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And can I just say one point about
sure.
this, is that Payne, from all the proceeds of Common Sense, and I think we can see Payne's sensibility here, all the proceeds that he gets, he doesn't use it to enhance himself. Instead, he donates it to the Continental Army to buy stores and provisions.
Yeah. And not to, I mean, Romney, it must be the wealthiest person who's ever run for president, but we also have a Senate that's filled with, there must be a handful of people who are not millionaires. And I'm wondering, he also, in Common Sense, outlines the setup of a government. A couple questions here. Would he be appalled by the amount of money that people who are in office now and the amount of money that it takes to run for office? And how did he outline all of those common people he championed, you so eloquently talked about? What should their role be in government, in his view?
It should be as wide as possible, is the simple way to say it. And just, I can tell you about one little detail, was that where Payne is from, right, he's in Philadelphia. Pennsylvania produces, at the time, before the federal constitution, produces the most radical state constitution that would enfranchise and give a voice to common people in the Republic. So much so, in fact, that one of the sticking points, I believe, is how often representatives should be elected. The more radical voices want them to be elected every year. And so we can think about that, how that's a structural change from our representatives now, who are every 2 years. So what would it mean for them every year to have to respond to their constituents?
We're going to welcome more phone calls. We're having our first back-to-school book club discussion, and this hour it is Common Sense, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. I still have, it's still hard for me to imagine people reading this pamphlet and this connection between this pamphlet, An Actual Revolution? How do you go from reading it to actually taking up arms? Where were people reading this, and how were words able to be translated into action? I'm interested in that, and you're interested in parts of this as well, so feel free to join our conversation. One line is open. Our guest is Russ Castronovo. He's a professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org, or leave messages if you'd like to on our Facebook page, too, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next to join us is Scott in Columbus. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Hi.
Having a little trouble hearing you on my headset, but I just wanted to put in a plug for a couple other books, and one is Howard Fast, Citizen Tom Paine, and there's another biography by Benjamin Levine, who grew up in Philadelphia, so he was steeped in the history of the Revolution. And these both of these books are quite different accounts of Tom Paine's early life and life through the through the Revolution and beyond. But they'll give a real good background and an insight into how he arrived at the point he did, with his participation in the Revolution.
And may I also add Professor Harvey Kay from UW-Green Bay, who's written extensively about Tom Paine.
Really tough life growing up in England, where someone could be executed, could be hung for, petty theft. And, I just think that we have lost touch so much with our history nowadays, and people just do not understand, the motivation, of a lot of people, our founding fathers. Thank you for taking the call.
Thank you very much for your call.
Yeah, to reiterate a point that you made, Kathleen, Harvey Kay's book on Tom Paine is really interesting, and I think a lot of your callers would find the first 20 pages fascinating, because he talks about all the different uses that Paine has been put to throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a general point, though, about your caller asking about what's happened to, we need to know our history better, and how do we invoke it? Every time politicians invoke John Adams or Thomas Paine, historians collectively have a stroke. It's just that there's no sort of, there isn't much accuracy in our political discourse when we return to the past. It's a very partisan use of the past. It's a very interested use of the past that often plays fast and loose with the facts. But we also might want to say that's part of that Paine tradition of selectively using material to create a point,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the point of propaganda.
One of our most frequently quoted politicians by Republicans and also by Democrats is Ronald Reagan, and he mm-hmm. Remembered Thomas Paine as well,
right.
And I want to get your response to this. This is Ronald Reagan at the Republican National Convention in July of 1980, mentioning, of course, Thomas Paine. Let's listen.
Everywhere we've met thousands of Democrats, independents, and Republicans from all economic conditions, all walks of life, bound together in that community of shared values of family, work, neighborhood, peace, and freedom. They're concerned, yes. They're not frightened. They're disturbed, but not dismayed. They are the kind of men and women Tom Paine had in mind when he wrote during the darkest days of the American Revolution, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again."
So do you imagine Ronald Reagan and Thomas Paine had the same thing in mind when they talked about beginning the world over again?
They might not have had the same content in mind, but they certainly had the same sort of methods in mind, right? The power of rhetoric. And what is it the other way that we call, what is the other way that we think of Reagan as but the great communicator?
He was indeed.
And that's something I think Paine would appreciate, and that's something that Reagan or his speechwriters appreciated about Paine. So it's not so much important as what they're saying as that each man recognized that it was about the how. about the mode and the medium that you use to impart a political message, whatever that message may be. And I think that's actually the true lesson of Tom Paine, not the content of what he's saying, but the way that we learn to communicate political points. So the question I always ask my students is this, and this is the question posed by Paine. You want to start a revolution. How are you going to do it? Are you going to appeal to the head or the heart? And that's what Paine effectively figured out.
I want to go back to the importance of this pamphlet. It's I want to talk about how people read this and how you go from this pamphlet with these ideas to action, into starting a revolution, for heaven's sake. That's such a big thing, to put your life on the line, to take up arms, to rebel against England. Oh, my goodness. How does that happen? Tell me about the process of reading this, how influential it was in actually moving words into action.
Well, I think we need to think about how the pamphlet moves. So it's not just this pamphlet, right? It's this pamphlet that gets reprinted in the colonial press, or gets summarized, or gets forwarded to people. And it's a pamphlet that I think makes people have a common identification. So I think the question is not how do you participate in a revolution, that is like, oh, am I going to take up arms? I think it's the question of, are we going to take up arms? And I think if you phrase the question that way, then it's a lot more credible. Then it's something that you can envision that much more readily. If you're just seeing yourself as an isolated a figure who's going to grab his musket and, you know, stare down the British army, that's one thing. But if you can understand that all of Boston and South Carolina and the people in the backwoods are going to share your cause, then I think it becomes much more doable, much more practical to imagine yourself as a revolutionary if you can see it as a common aspiration.
Mm. And even if you couldn't read, there would be people who would perhaps be sitting in public houses reading this out loud.
Exactly. This is Paine wrote it in a way, and many of your callers have replayed this for us by reading stirring passages. And those passages would get read in the, you know, tobacco-filled rooms of taverns, or they would get repeated in public squares, or they would be, you know, heard on the docks. That this type of language was something that was readily repeatable, that was memorable, and was something that could easily be shared. And that's the way Paine wrote his pamphlet, and that's the way that it gets used.
Mm. Don in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm calling about the idea Paine wrote about providing a stake to every citizen at birth. And I'm wondering if the guests could talk a little bit about how in the early years of Wisconsin statehood, the Paine societies that sprung up after the Germans immigrated here in other places might have influenced the what I call the eco-progressive intellectual heritage of Madison, the La Follette through Leopold tradition.
Mm.
And if you could comment on how that stake, which at the time was land or cash, would relate to, say, the land ethic.
You know, that is a great, great point. And what I like about great, great points is that so often they contain their own answer. And I think if you could just take that sentence or that question and phrase it as a sentence, you get the answer. That is a Paine. There is this line, there is this legacy that extends from Paine to this notion of individual stakeholders being given land or some sort of economic interest so they can play a vital role in society. Unfortunately, however, even at the time of the Revolution, this did not translate. Confiscated loyalist estates were supposed to be given to common people as these kind of individual stakes that your caller refers to. However, more often than not, they ended up in the hands of already well-to-do colonists. So the revolution, which was supposed to, let's say, distribute wealth and capital for some more widely, really didn't have that effect. And it's nice to think, for me, as someone who's also in Madison, that where its fruit was became ripe was in the progressive and environmental movement that we see emerging in Wisconsin.
And thank you very much for the call. What do we need? We have a last minute here. What do we need to remember about Thomas Paine? What thought do we want to leave this conversation with, our book club?
I think that we've stressed a couple points, which is commonality being a crucial one. And what I would like to say is that commonality for Paine was not limited to an American sensibility. He had so when we have the Ronald Reagan quote, right, the world starts anew. Mm-hmm. That's where Paine's horizon was. It was not a national, narrowed to a national focus, because he had seen how a national or state focus could easily become the source of war and constant militarism. What Paine felt was that there was if we could have trade, a free trade, if we could have common interest, that the world would be a better place. And one of the things that I find really interesting is after common sense, what Paine next turns his attention to is a bridge. That is a literal bridge, an yes. iron bridge that he yes. wants to design. And I think that's a really good metaphor for what Paine was also trying to do politically, right? He wants to create a bridge, not only between Pennsylvania and New York, but between warring states, right? He wants to create a bridge between revolutionary France and England. But of course, Paine's a radical enough where the way he thinks that bridge is going to go is that revolutionary France will spread to England, and England will become revolutionary England. But I really think that we need to preserve that idea of a bridge, about making connections, about crossing over the deep chasms that separate us.
Hmm. Oh, Russ, thank you so much. It's just been a marvelous discussion, and I'm so glad we started with this book. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to the next one.
I am too. That's the thing. There's always another book, right? Russ Castronovo, our teacher, professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison. Common Sense, in case you just tuned us in, is what we were talking about. The school year will continue on October 31st. Russ will be back and we'll talk about the Federalist Papers 4, 9, 10, and 51. Written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. So that's coming up on October 31st. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Ron the Fanning, who produced this program. Thanks for being at school.
Long live rock and roll. The beat of the drums loud and bold.